be working on that. Have you run into any problems on that? Yeah, no one has run into any problems, but there's a reason why they haven't run into any problems.
Different people become different nations at times when they're conquered. They assimilate and unassimilate and flow and believe.
You might have to just generalize, and you might, what we're really looking for is basically what they were at the beginning before they were conquered, if you can find that. Now, some of them, what you'll find is that, you know, you'll look it up and it will say a group of Canaanites that lived in southern Palestine, and that's all. And you look in another Bible dictionary, group of Canaanites that lived in northern Palestine. You know, and then you look in another one, group of Canaanites that lived in eastern Palestine. And you'll find it will really vary with some of them. So you might not know the exact location or hardly anything about a couple of those. Now, most of them you can find something about, though. You might have to look in like the major Bible encyclopedias like McClintock and Strong or something like that in the library. Well, we're talking about Egypt today. We're going to talk about Egypt probably all of today and then all of next Thursday as well. And Egypt is a fascinating country, has a very interesting history. Today we're going to look at more of the academic points about Egypt. We're going to look at the land itself briefly, and then we're going to look at some of the history that the Bible talks about and contemporary history during that time talks about. We mentioned yesterday that the temperature is very temperate, very dry, and as a result of the dry climate, archaeological remains have lasted longer in Egypt than almost anywhere else in the world. It's a veritable outdoor museum, really, is what it amounts to, the land of Egypt. In fact, during the time of the Romans, it was very, very customary for the Romans to take a vacation and go see the ruins of Egypt, for they were ruins even by that time. Like during the time of Jesus, the pyramids were already almost 2,500 years old, see. And so they were ruins back then, and that was a very, very customary thing to go on vacations to the land of Egypt. Well, during the Middle Ages, the land was regarded as an area of great mystery, and there was a certain mystique about it. There was a certain intrigue about it. People were enchanted by it. In fact, a lot of people would try to get there as almost a spiritual pilgrimage type thing during the Middle Ages. And a number of bodies were found in the sand, and they remained remarkably well-preserved because of the weather. Now, the primary geographic feature of the land of Egypt is the Nile River. You cannot understand Egypt unless you know something about the Nile River. Pretty much their whole history and their whole country centered around the Nile River. In fact, Egypt has been called the gift of the Nile. The gift of the Nile. In other words, the land was given to the Nile River, as it were, implying that if the river did not exist, if the river was not there, then there would be no land, really. You could not live there, because it's the river that makes life possible in this northeastern section of Africa. And without it, Egypt would really only be a desolate corner of the Sahara Desert. It's considered to be the very bloodstream of the land of Egypt, and it made it the very breadbasket of the ancient world during that time. In fact, even later on during the Romans, they were able to grow so many crops and so much grain that they shipped them on big ships all the way around Asia Minor and all the way to the city of Rome itself. But the Nile River, of course, is flowing down through this area here. And it's surrounded pretty much by desert, except on the south, which is tropical forest if you were to go far enough south, and on the north by the Mediterranean Ocean. So you've got this little narrow stretch of fertile soil that is pretty fertile through irrigation and so forth, but beyond that, it would just simply be desert. Now, the Egyptians were always puzzled as to the origin of the Nile River. They didn't know where it came from during the time of their empire. And you see, the Nile River is over 4,000 miles long, and so it started way down in Central Africa, and they'd never been down there. And so, since it flowed northward from Central Africa, their mythology suggested that the river had its origin in heaven. That's what they believed, that the river began in heaven and that it fell to the earth somewhere far south of Egypt. and there was a real mysterious concept connected with the river. In fact, the famous Book of the Dead, which was really their Bible of their time, stated that the river sprang from the four sources at the 12th gate of the netherworld, wherever that is. But that's where the river supposedly derived its source from in heaven. Well, the river had such a strong influence on the Egyptians that they actually deified it, and it was their god. They made it one of their gods. They called it the god Hapi, spelled H-A-P-I, like this. And they actually made it a god. They actually worshipped the Nile River, believed it was one of their gods. They had many other gods as well, but it was the very center for their Egyptian culture. And you see, when God brought the 10 devastating plagues on the land of Egypt, every one of those plagues was directly an attack on one of their gods. And when God took the river and turned it into blood and it stunk and it was a stench in their nostrils, that was showing that their god was weaker than the Israelites' god. Well, we find that the river actually does not come from the four sources of the 12th gate at the netherworld. Actually, where it comes from is from two different streams that are actually located in Central Africa. If you were to look on a map, which we don't have, it's cut off, but there's an area called Khartoum in modern Sudan, and it really has its source in modern Sudan. And it starts off with two different streams. One is called the White Nile, and the other is called the Blue Nile. And the White Nile is the stream on the west, and it actually flows about 1,650 miles from Lake Victoria. Lake Victoria is a very, very large lake in Central Africa. And so it flows 1,650 miles from Lake Victoria, and that's called the White Nile. And then the other one is called the Blue Nile. And the Blue Nile flows about 1,000 miles from northern Ethiopia. Northern Ethiopia, about 1,000 miles. And so what they do, they meet together, the White Nile with the Blue Nile, and they form the Nile River. And then it just simply is known as the Nile, no longer the white or the blue. And of course, that's off of our map as well. You cannot see the white and the Nile on that particular map there. So if you measure the total length of the Nile River then, which includes the White Nile, normally if they measure the entire length, they also add in the distance of the White Nile, it is 4,157 miles. Now, that makes it the longest river in the world. It's not the largest river. I think maybe the Amazon is, but it is the longest river as far as actual distance. And the reason why, it follows all these numerous twists and turns and so forth, which explains its great length. And that would include the distance of the White Nile starting in Lake Victoria. Well, the Nile was also Egypt's most important trade route. They would use this as their superhighway. They didn't have any major roads flowing down the heart of their land. All they had was the Nile River and this little Nile River valley. And so they would sail up the Nile River. And you could sail for a long, long distance. In fact, you could literally sail 600 miles south on the Nile River before you came to the first obstruction, which is called a cataract or a waterfall. And the trade winds often blew from the south, so they would hoist the sails, and they could literally sail upstream and make fairly good time, and they would sail 600 miles up the river. So that's pretty much how they were able to keep their land unified, is sailing up the Nile River. And the sailing was pretty smooth for the first 600 miles. Now, after the first 600 miles, you encounter six different cataracts. And a cataract is just simply big granite obstructions that the river flows over, and the water becomes real turbulent, swift rapids, waterfalls, and so forth. And what they become then eventually are just simply boundaries. And that's why the Egyptians never were able to get any farther than that, because on both sides it's just simply sand and desert. They couldn't get out that way, and they would go as far as the cataracts, and they were so hard to get over and get around and everything, they never proceeded to the headwaters of the Nile River. Well, it's also interesting that the Nile floods yearly, although not always predictably. It's not always predictable as far as its flooding time. Now, I don't think it floods today. I think they've got like the Aswan Dam and other things like that that control the flooding today. But back during that time, it flooded every single year, although the extent varied from year to year. Now, in the flood season, what the river became was a ferocious tyrant. And the river would sweep down, and it would flatten their homes, and it would ruin their crops. In fact, normally it was a pretty customary thing for many of the Egyptians to just rebuild their homes every year. They would build their home, and then You know, springtime would come, and the snow would start falling in Central Africa, high up in the mountains, and it would melt in the springtime, and up in the Abyssinia Mountains, and as it would melt, it'd flow into the Nile River, and it would raise the waters more than 15 feet above flood level, and it would flatten their homes. And so their homes were flattened, and they were just, in fact, a lot of them lived in boats then. And they lived in boats or high up, you know, as far as they could get away from the floodwaters. And then when the waters abated, they would plant their crops, and they'd rebuild their homes. And that was just kind of an annual thing to have your homes destroyed very, very frequently. And it would remain at flood stage for almost a week like that. But the real blessing in disguise is the fact that it left behind a deep, deep layer of black, fertile silt. And the Nile River Valley is probably one of the most fertile areas in the entire world. It's very, very fertile. So the real boon out of all this is that they got abundant harvest every single year. Well, there was also another blessing in disguise for the Egyptians when the river flooded annually, and that's this. They began to predict the river cycles because it would flood at a certain time of the year, and they began to observe the stars, and they began to observe the moon and the position of the sun. And what that led to was the creation of a very early Egyptian calendar. And some of the discoveries in Egyptian astronomy were really phenomenal. They noticed that the river flooded basically, although not always predictably, it flooded basically at the same time of the year when certain constellations were in certain locations. And they had a phenomenal understanding of astronomy. They knew that the Earth was round. They knew that the Earth revolved around the sun. They knew the approximate distance of the sun from the Earth being about 93 million miles, I believe. They knew basically, and almost very accurately, how long it took the Earth to rotate around the sun as well. They had a fairly accurate calendar. So they had a fair amount of knowledge that later on was lost, even up to the time of Columbus. I mean, even during the time of Columbus, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Well, even during that time, you know, the Spaniards and everyone said, Columbus, you're crazy. The world is flat. You're going to fall off the end of the ocean. And they had all these caricatures of the monsters on the other side of the ocean when you fell off. And there was a dragon waiting there with his mouth open to swallow up any ship that even ventured near the end of the ocean. The Egyptians were much smarter than that. They had a lot more knowledge. And they built their pyramids around the curvature of the earth and a number of other facts. Had a lot of understanding in this area. And furthermore, as the Egyptian scribes began to record the annual changes of the river, they actually developed the Egyptian system of writing called hieroglyphic writing. And there's three different stages of that writing, which I won't get into. But basically, the scribes were writing down every single year when the river flooded, what time of the year, how much it flooded. In fact, they actually have found in many places of Egypt actual etches and marks on some of the rock cliffs beside the Nile River that show the flood stages at various times, and they're very, very ancient. And so that led to many advances in the development of Egyptian writing, trying to record when the flood occurred, and they have a very unique pictograph-type writing system. Well, there is another geographic feature of the land of Egypt, and that's called the Nile Delta. The Nile Delta. And every single year, the Nile deposits rich soil as it dumps into the Mediterranean Sea. And what happens is that the river's flowing down with all the silt, and all of a sudden it hits the Mediterranean Sea, and the speed of the river slows down, and it drops the silt, deposits the silt. And so you've got a very fertile area right here at the mouth of the Nile River called the Nile Delta. It's kind of like a triangle in shape. And there was very good farming in that area as well, very rich area for agriculture. There's also another key point about the Nile Delta, and that's this. Because of its proximity to the Mediterranean Ocean, there was a fair amount of contact with the outside world. If you lived on the Nile Delta, there were ships that came from other parts of the world and they docked there. And there were foreigners that came through the Sinai Peninsula to the Nile Delta. However, if you lived on this part of the Nile River, you were very, very secluded. Hardly anyone except for Egyptians came to that area. So they were a lot more exposed to outsiders. That is the ones that lived on the Nile Delta. There were also brushy thickets here on the Nile Delta, and there the papyrus reed grew. And perhaps you've seen pictures of the papyrus reed. It pretty much just looks, like some of the reeds and the rushes that grow in our swamps, I suppose. Very similar to that, just simply tall grass almost, like a cattail without the head on it. But these reeds grew in the waters there and in the swamps in the Nile Delta, And they were actually made into paper, and they would use them for writing material, and they would write their hieroglyphics on it. And also, they would use it for baskets and for ropes and for sandals, and they even built boats out of it. And in fact, a number of people have speculated that they built boats and they were able to sail to the Americas on those boats. I think that was what, Kon-Tiki, was that the name of it? That kind of ventured on that thesis that they built a papyrus boat, and I think they actually succeeded. I think they maybe built one or two of those things, and the first one didn't make it or whatever. My memory is a little fuzzy here, but I remember reading the book a long time ago and seeing the pictures in the National Geographic. And incidentally, if you look at some of the ruins in Central and in South America, they're very, very similar to many of them in Egypt as well, as far as the pyramids and the Mayans and the knowledge that they had, very, very similar to what Egypt had. So that might be a good possibility. Now, the other geographic feature of the land of Egypt is called the Nile Valley. The Nile Valley. And that, of course, would be the remainder of the land of Egypt outside of the Delta now. And that we're talking about the little narrow belt of land that follows for the 600 miles or so along the Nile River itself, that directly hugs the Nile River, the Nile Valley. And it really varies in width from about 1 mile to 24 miles. So we're really not talking about much land here. Sometimes it narrows all the way down to a chasm only 1 mile in width. And also on the sides of it, there are walls that rise quite high into the atmosphere, sometimes 1,000 to 200 feet in height. And then on top of those walls, those rock cliffs, the desert begins. And so really, it's a very, very narrow river valley. It's very dry, too. In fact, it's the driest part of all of Egypt. In fact, sometimes it will go for years without raining here and will not rain. So the only source of water then is the Nile River itself. And even though it's dry, it's very, very fertile because of the moisture and the rich soil from the Nile River. Now, the geographical location of Nile, of the land of Egypt, is really significant. And you really can't understand the culture of Egypt without knowing something about the geographical location of the land itself. If you look carefully at our map here, you'll notice that Egypt covered the northeast shoulder of Africa itself, right up there in the northeast. And it's bordered by the Sahara Desert to the west. That's this vast desert right here. On the south are the tropical forests of Nubia on the south, which really are impassable. There's no way you could get to Egypt during that time from the south. On the west here is the Red Sea with the Gulf of Aqaba right here, the Gulf of Suez right here. And in between the Red Sea and the Nile River Valley is a series of mountain ranges and also desert. So there's no way you could ever approach the land of Egypt from this direction either. So there was only one method of approach, and that's through the Sinai Peninsula or the Mediterranean Sea. Those were the only ways you could ever get to the land of Egypt. And that made really the land of Egypt then very, very isolated. Very isolated. There's no way you could get to it during that time except primarily through the Sinai Peninsula. And so almost every single invasion that came into the land of Egypt, of course, came through the Sinai Peninsula, which is this area right here, which is pretty much the way the Israelites left when they left the land of Egypt. And the attackers, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, later on the Greeks and the Romans, most of them would march down through the land of Palestine and then across the Sinai and then down into Egypt. So that caused Egypt to be very, very isolated. It was pretty much the end of the road. And so really it had an ideal location. And there are two things about this location that I think are significant. The first one is that the location of Egypt, it was a very, very fertile area because of the Nile River. Even though it's not a big area, only 13,000 square miles, it was very fertile, and so therefore they had a very high level of prosperity. The crops were good. They were able to get a lot of money off of selling their crops and so forth. So they could support a very great civilization on a very small area. And that's just what they did. They had a great civilization, and they could support it because of their agricultural base. But then secondly, the second significant thing about their location is not only were they prosperous as far as agriculture, but secondly, they were isolated from all the other conquerors that conquered the other lands. They were isolated from the Babylonians. They were isolated from the Assyrians. They were isolated from the Persians. And even though those nations came down and sometimes partially conquered Egypt, Egypt was still pretty much separate. And what that enabled them to do is to build a continuous society and continuous culture and a continuous civilization without any interruption. See, we talked about the land of Babylon and the land of Assyria. We brought out how they were really advanced, like the Sumerians and so forth. But what happened to them is that they would get a culture going, like the Babylonians, and someone would come down and decimate them. Someone would come down and conquer them and, you know, exile them or uproot them or kill them or whatever. And then the Assyrians would take over. And then pretty soon the Assyrians were conquered by the Persians. And then the same thing happened to the Persians. But down here in Egypt, that didn't happen. And they were pretty much exclusive. They were pretty much isolated. So they were just building and building and building and building their culture, literally, for hundreds and hundreds of years. Well, Egypt is known to its own people as Temeri. This is what they called their land. Temeri, which means the beloved land. That's spelled T-A-M-E-R-I, the beloved land. That's what they called it. So they did not call it Egypt, or they didn't call it Mitzrayim like the Hebrews did. They called it Temeri, the beloved land. They also called it Kemet, which you don't need to write down, but Kemet means the black country, descriptive of the black soil that was along the shores of the Nile River. Yes? I think so. I think that there was. In fact, we see a progression of a loss of knowledge. And yet, when you look at Egypt, there was just an incredible amount of knowledge that they had during their time. And see, what happened is that they migrated after the flood from the area of Babel, the Tower of Babel. That's where they migrated from. That's where the division of the nations came. So they took the knowledge that the Babylonians had, the same knowledge as far as astronomy and so forth. They took that down into Egypt and built their culture and were not constantly interrupted. And the Babylonians started off with that knowledge, but they were constantly interrupted. So they didn't have near the knowledge that the Egyptians had later on in time. Just amazing things have been found in the land of Egypt. Things that I've read about, electrical batteries and cataract operations done on people, and just amazing things. Yes? Huh. Was it made in Japan? Wasn't, huh? That was before they made the market, huh? I thought maybe it would be made in Japan there. But, huh. What's that? Yeah, maybe. Our brother said it was the first shipment to the United States, and it apparently sunk in transit, huh? Well, then there's another geographical location connected to Egypt here that I'm going to mention. It's the big triangle called the Sinai Peninsula. The Sinai Peninsula, and that's this huge area right here, which is pretty much all wilderness. The Sinai Peninsula. And you'll notice on the map there that it borders Egypt to the northeast. It's a very arid region that served as a buffer zone. No one was able to live there, so there weren't, except for maybe the Edomites down here to the south, but it pretty much was uninhabited. So it was a large buffer zone that kind of padded them from all the other ancient societies during that time. As we mentioned earlier in our study, there are two gulfs here, the Gulf of Suez on the left and the Gulf of Aqaba on the right. That pretty much defines the boundaries of the Sinai Peninsula. All the conquerors came down across the Sinai Peninsula to march into the land of Egypt. That's where most of the conquerors came from. Now, how about the origin of the Egyptian people? Where did they come from? What is their origin? Evidently, you're looking at two periods of time now. You're looking at people that lived in Egypt before the flood. They're called antediluvian people, people that lived there before the time of the flood. As far as them, where they came from and what their makeup was like, that pretty much is unknown to historians and scholars. But then after the flood, descendants of Ham. Remember the Bible talks about Ham. There were three sons of Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Well, descendants of Ham settled in this area. So after the flood, Egypt was Hamitic in nature. In fact, there are two scriptures here that tell us this in Psalm chapter 105, verse 23. Psalm 105, verse 23. It says that Israel came into Egypt and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. And then down in verse 27 of Psalm 105, they showed his signs among them and wonders in the land of Ham. So in other words, the Bible talks about the Hamites settled in this land of Egypt. Now there was one particular son of Ham that stopped in the land of Egypt, and apparently he is the founder and the progenitor of the Egyptians. His name is called Mizraim.
Mizraim. Spelled like this.
And that's seen in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 6. Genesis 10, 6. It's spelled M-I-Z-R-A-I-M, Mizraim. Now, Egypt was founded by him then after the flood. In fact, there are some tablets that have been discovered. I'm going to talk about them later on in our little section on archaeology, but they're called the Tel El Amarna tablets. And they actually indicate that the Canaanites called the land of Mitzri, like this. This is what the Canaanites called it, M-I-Z-I, Mitzri, during the time of, let's say, when right before Israel came into the Promised Land, it was called the land of Mitzri. Well, that's a variation of the same form, Mizraim, that's talked about in the Bible. And the Hebrews called the land, like Abraham and others, they called it the land of Mizraim. That was the land of Egypt. That's what it was called, Mizraim. And incidentally, we have a fairly good idea what the Egyptians looked like, because they painted their picture on a number of walls. And their pictures are very, very common in the ancient tombs and the ancient ruins of Egypt. And we've also got a number of embalmed bodies of ancient Egyptians as well, although most of them look like dried prunes. And so it's kind of hard to tell what a person looked like when you look at that. But most of the Egyptians were fairly short in stature. They were brown-skinned, although they were not black-skinned. They were brown-skinned, and they had stiff brown hair. And they were very handsome people, very beautiful people, you might say. Very handsome, very beautiful people. They spoke a language that came from what has been called a Hamito-Semitic background. That is, it has traits of languages from northern Africa and also from southern Asia Minor. So it was kind of a unique language. Traits of Ham and Shem were in their language. And for that, you can see the following passages. That would be Genesis chapter 10, verses 6 through 20. Genesis 10, 6 through 20, and also Genesis chapter 10, 21 through 31. Genesis 10, 21 through 31. Now, what Genesis 10, 6 through 20 will tell you about is the descendants of northern Africa, and then what chapter 10, 21 through 31 will tell you about is descendants of southern Asia Minor. And what they had were traits of both of those descendants. They kind of spoke a Semitic language from Shem and also a Hamitic language from Ham. Okay. Let's move on to another point. Let's talk about the history of Egypt, just real briefly. Let's go back through. Let's talk about the history of the land of Egypt. This is really complicated. It's not going to be very easy for us just in a short period of time to talk about their history. It's often obscure. It's often difficult to reconstruct. So I'm going to give you a real simplistic outline of their history, talk about some of the major pharaohs, major leaders, and how it ties in with Bible history. It goes all the way back to an Egyptian priest whose name was Manetho. We talked about him earlier. And Manetho wrote a history of ancient Egypt. And so he lived around 305 to 285 BC. 305 to 285 BC. And he wrote this history in the Greek language. And what he did, he basically divided the history of the kings And incidentally, the term pharaoh is just the Egyptian word for king. So it's not one title of any one Egyptian. It's a kind of means the idea of a king. But he divided the history of the Egyptian kings into what are called 30 periods, 30 periods of time. And so I'm going to mention some of these different periods of time for you. Now, these are known as dynasties by scholars. 30 different dynasties, 30 different periods of time. Now, a dynasty is simply, really, a dynasty is a succession of rulers from the same line or from the same descent. That's called a dynasty. For example, in the land of Israel, there was the dynasty of David in Judah. Every single king that came from David was in the line or the descent of David. So there was only one dynasty. But up in northern Israel, there were several dynasties. There was the dynasty of Omri. There was the dynasty of Jeroboam and his descendants. And then an entirely different family would take over and start a new dynasty. Well, that's what happened in Egypt as well. There were over 30 different dynasties, 30 different families or 30 different descents that took over and ruled Egypt at any one given period of time. And they go back and they start with a king called Menes, and I'll write his name down on the board, who lived sometime during the time of the shortly after the flood, all the way back around 2500 BC. And it goes all the way up to the time, basically, of Alexander the Great, which is around 331 BC. So we're looking at that basic period of time, from Menes, 2500 BC, up to Alexander the Great. So I think what I'll do, the best way to do this is write these down on the board. And we're not going to talk about the early portion of Manetho's work. Actually, you kind of wonder about old Manetho, because the portion that we're looking at seems to be pretty accurate. But he also wrote about the earlier periods of Egyptian history in which the Egyptian pharaohs were said to be gods. And they descended down on the earth, and they lived to be like 25,000 years old or 35,000 years old. And they're very, very mythical in nature. So kind of makes you wonder, if he's writing about all these pharaohs, 25,000 years old and so forth, that are gods, you kind of wonder how much of the rest of his history you can really trust, if you know what I mean. But let me divide them up into seven periods of time for you. I'm going to take all 30 dynasties, divide them up into seven periods of time, and then talk about each one of these periods real briefly. Kind of give you just maybe a couple key events that happen in each one of them. Number one, it starts with what is called the early dynastic period. And that really begins like, let's just put 2500 plus or minus, and we'll just put an arrow on like that, just saying it begins then, and we're not really certain exactly when it ends, but we put 2500 plus or minus because we dated the flood at 2500. And shortly after the flood thereof, I think the Tower of Babel was built maybe 100 years after the flood, and the Egyptians would have migrated, that is, Mitzrayim, from the Tower of Babel 100 years or so after the flood. So we put a plus or minus just to let you know this is not the exact time when Egypt started. We don't know the exact time, but sometime shortly after the flood in the Tower of Babel. And during this time, there are dynasties, and I'm going to just abbreviate now, like that. There are dynasties 1 and 2 that occur during that time. Okay? And then we have a second major period of time, and that's called the Old Kingdom period. And the Old Kingdom period would be it's kind of hard to tell when it begins, but it goes up to 2194 BC. So it's hard to tell when this one stops and when this one starts. And that would be Dynasties chapter. You can tell what I've been doing for years. Dynasties chapter 3 and verse 6. No, it's Dynasties 3 through 6. And this is the time of the Great Pyramid. This is when the pyramids were built. Sometime in this period, although they're hard to date as well. And then number 3, that would be the first intermediate period. And that would be from 2193 to sometime around
1991 BC, and that's dynasties 7 through 11, and this is when Abraham came down to the land of Egypt. So we put Abraham in that period of time. And then number 4, maybe I should,
is this going to be in your way right there? It's going to be in your way.
Number 4 would be the Middle Kingdom period. And in the Middle Kingdom period, that dates from about 1990 to sometime around 1731. And there's only one dynasty during this period, Dynasty 12. And this is the time of Joseph and Jacob in the land of Egypt. Now I need to go over to this board and write a little bit on this board over here. I need to move this. Number 5 would be the second intermediate period. Number 6 is called the New Empire period. I'm going to go back and say just a few things about each one of these here, just in a couple of seconds. Okay, let me go back and say something about these. There is one of them that I would like to have you remember. If you're listening on tape, maybe what I'll have you do is just see someone else's notes. It's kind of hard to really explain this just simply verbally. But number 5 is the second intermediate period from 1730 to 1569. That's dynasties 13 through 17. And then number 6 is called the New Empire period from 1568 to 1085, dynasties 18 through 20. That is the time in which Egypt was a world government. They were a world power. Now, out of all of these dynasties, I'd like to have you remember that one. That's why I put a little star beside it, because I want you to remember when they were a world government. So try to remember that for me if you could. And then number 7 is the decline period from 1084 to 332 BC, and that's dynasties 21 through 30. You can tell it's a very lengthy period of time, and so it was all downhill from that point in time. Let's go back and let's talk about these basic periods of time, just real briefly so you can kind of understand some of the key events that occurred in each one of them. First of all, we go back and we start with the early dynastic period and the old kingdom period. Let's put them together because they're really kind of nebulous as far as exactly what happened in those periods of time. There was a king that came to power and his name was Medes. He was pretty much the first famous Pharaoh, and his name is spelled M-E-N-E-S, Menes. And he came to power, and at the time in which he came to power, Egypt, for the most part, was almost two separate countries. It was divided into Upper and Lower Egypt. And what he did, he united these two areas. He put them together. He made them one country.
and they had been separated, but he made them one. And he also brought in a new god, and it was called the sky god. His name was Horus. And he made it the national god, and that's spelled H-O-R-U-S. So Horus became the first major Egyptian god. In fact, he claimed that he was the incarnation of Horus and believed that he was the sky god. And from that point on, the Egyptians pretty much venerated their pharaohs as being an incarnation of their god. Now, his name is identified by a number of scholars as Mitzrayim. Remember the name I gave you just a little bit earlier as far as what the Israelites and what the Hebrews called the land of Egypt? They called it Mitzrayim. And a number of scholars have identified Menes as Mitzrayim. So he may have been one of the sons of Ham, and he was the one that went down there and united both sections of these, of both Lower and Upper Egypt. And he may have been about contemporary with Nimrod. Remember we talked about Nimrod and how he built the Tower of Babel? He may have been contemporary with Nimrod, and so while Nimrod was laying the foundations of Babylon and the Tower of Babel, then shortly thereafter, Mitzrayim, later known as Menes, came down into Egypt and was doing the same in Egypt. I'm not totally certain that Mitzrayim and Menes are the same, though. Now, the Old Kingdom period is also known as the Pyramid Age period, because that's when the pyramids were built. And we'll talk about the pyramids a little bit later on. Phenomenal pieces of architecture. Just really amazing things that were done. And during the Old Kingdom period, the pharaohs reigned with great power during those dynasties. They were not yet a world government, but they had great power. And you can even see that by the very pyramids they built. They did things on a grand scale. They had a lot of power and wielded a lot of authority throughout the land of Egypt. Then we come to another period called the First Intermediate period. And that, of course, is from about 2193 to 1991, Dynasty 7 through 11. That's when Abraham came down during that period of time. And this was a time of great social upheaval for Egypt. It was a time in which a lot of the authority that the pharaohs had wielded was gone from them. They lost their authority. In fact, there was almost a total collapse of the central government. And what happened is that there were a lot of different local princes, kind of little petty kings, you might say, throughout the land of Egypt, and they were vying for power, and at last many of them did become independent, and there was a lot of division, there's a lot of upheaval, a lot of chaos in the land of Egypt. And it was during the 11th dynasty that Abraham came down into the land of Egypt for relief from the famine in Palestine. Of course, he got into trouble for that, but he shouldn't have ever done that. He should have just believed God and stayed in the promised land, but be that what it may. That's found in Genesis chapter 12, verses 12 through 20. Genesis 12, 12 through 20. Okay, well, let's move on to another period of time. When we move on in our thinking, we come to the Middle Kingdom period. And the Middle Kingdom period began roughly around 2000 BC. You can see 1990 to 1731. And it began when a king called Amenemhat I, forced all these rebellious princes into subjection. Can I erase this now? Can I erase this over here? Maybe the top portion here. And I'll write a few of these pharaohs down for you because it's really hard to spell their names by sound. If I don't write their name down on the board, then don't worry about them. And if you're interested in more of an elaboration of the history of this period, just look in Wycliffe's Historical Geography. They'll talk about many of these pharaohs, give you the history that I'm talking about. Amenemhat. So he came to power during the Middle Kingdom period, and he beat the princes into subjection. He also made a new god. His name was Amen. Looks kind of familiar, doesn't it? Named it after himself, humbly. So, but Amen, that's spelled A-M-U-N. Amen. Amenemhat is spelled A-M-E-N-E-M-H-E-T, the first. And he made this the new national god of his kingdom, and it became the national god of the Egyptians during this time. And he required that if you're going to be a loyal Egyptian, then you need to worship this god, i.e. you need to worship me. And so he forced all Egyptians to worship Amen in obedience to him, and it was really a test of their political allegiance. There was also a major city that came into power that he ruled from, the city of Thebes, which really was a beautiful city that the Pharaohs had built. That's spelled T-H-E-B-E-S. That became his capital and the center of worship and the seat of great power. Well, we know that Joseph was brought down to Egypt during this basic period of time, the Middle Kingdom period. He was brought down to Egypt as a slave sometime around 1876 B.C. About 1876 B.C. You can read the account in Genesis chapter 37. And I think most of us are familiar with how he was sold to the Ishmaelites and taken down and sold as a slave into the house of Potiphar. And then, of course, thrown into prison, spent a couple of years there in prison. And then several years later, he became an officer, second only to Pharaoh, in a united, very, very powerful Egypt. And that's found in Genesis chapter 41, where you can read about that. Genesis 41. Well, during this time of Joseph, when the Middle Kingdom period was flourishing, it was a time of great prosperity for the Egyptians. Great prosperity, great advancement in culture, time in which their art flourished, their literature flourished during this time. It all blossomed. Peaceful conditions prevailed. It was a very brilliant, very powerful period. And during that time, the Egyptians began to trade with outsiders. They trade with, for example, the island of Crete and the land of Palestine and Syria up to the north of Palestine and other lands as well. But then we come to the second intermediate period, which is from 1730 to 1569. And during that period, it was a very, very difficult time for Egypt as a country, very chaotic time again. Because shortly, sometime before 1700, there was a group of people called the Hyksos. I'll just write their names right there. And the Hyksos came down into the land of Egypt. That's spelled H-Y-K-S-O-S. And they were actually not Egyptians. They were foreign rulers. They came from the land of Asia. Up there where Turkey is. And they came from the land of Asia, and they seized control of Egypt. And they conquered pretty much most of the land, and they ruled. And they subjugated the Egyptians. So they were really foreign conquerors, you might say, that ruled over them. And they made a new capital called Heliopolis, which was a different capital than the capital of Thebes. And they also came up with a new god. They came up with a god called Re, which is simply spelled R-E, who was the sun god. The god Re, spelled R-E. And they worshipped this sun god. Now, and that became their national god. And apparently they were the strongest in Lower Egypt, down around by the Nile Delta. And they didn't gain full control over Upper Egypt during that time. And incidentally, you'll read in a number of different sources, it's kind of obscure about the Hyksos. It's not a real clear period. Namely, because once the Egyptians finally booted them out, they destroyed every remnant, every trace of the Hyksos. They tore down every monument. They tore down every single description that they could possibly find about them. Yes? Yes, they came down from part of Asia. So they weren't Egyptians at all. Now, when I talk about Asia, Asia in ancient times meant something different than what it means today. Back in ancient times, Asia was this country right here. All of this country here. It wasn't like over in Thailand and over in India, but it was this country which is the area of modern Turkey today. So they came down and they conquered Egypt, the Hyksos.
Would they have been like the Hittites?
Well, I think they were a different people than the Hittites, if I'm not mistaken. They came from that area that the Hittites came from, no. But I think they were pretty much a different group of people. Well, finally, there was a pharaoh. His name was King Khemous. King Khemous. And he came to power. I don't really need to write it down because it's not that important that you remember it. But King Khemous came to power, and he broke the power of the Hyksos, defeated them, overcame them, and he united the nation again. And he returned the capital back to Thebes again. And it was too hard to get rid of the god Re because that was firmly ingrained in the Egyptians' minds by now. So what he did, he combined Amun and Re. Amun is over there, and Re is right there. He put them together and made them a new god. See, kind of a hybrid god, Amun-Re. And the Egyptians really had a penchant for just adding to their gods. They added to their gods. They never threw away any gods. They always just kept them. And by the time they were done, they had so many gods. They had a cat god and a baboon god and a crocodile god, and they worshipped these animals and so forth. They had many, many different gods. They just added them one to the other. And so Amun-Re became the new god. And what this paved the way for was the new kingdom period. And so that brings us to number six, the New Kingdom or the New Empire period. And with that, that begins with Amenhotep.
He was one of the major pharaohs.
Amenhotep the First. And he came to power in 1568 BC. And he, of course, named himself after the god Amen and also called himself the son of Re, believing that he was the incarnation of Amen-Re, the sun god. And he was able to march into Western Asia. He was able to conquer Palestine. He was able to conquer Syria. And so eventually, he was able to conquer the then-known world. And he pretty much controlled all the land from the land of Egypt up through Palestine, up into Asia, that country I just showed you, and pretty much all the way over to the Euphrates River. And that became the first world empire under Amenhotep the First and also his successors. Now, there is one other pharaoh that I'm going to mention during this period, and I'm sure most of you have heard of him, Tutankhamun. King Tut, you've heard of King Tut? Am I pronouncing that right, Tutankhamun? Does anyone know? What? Tutankhamun? King Tut, you've heard of King Tut. Well, it's spelled like this. I'm not sure how you would pronounce his name, but spelled like this. I want to say just a couple things about him. Tutankhamun. And he reigned from 1366 to 1357. Not a real long period of time. That's spelled Tutankhamun. Tutankhamun from 1366 to 1357. Sometimes known as the boy king. He was very young when he died and also very young when he ruled. In fact, he was only 18 years old when he died. So he must have started to reign when he was like 9 or 10 or maybe 11 years old, see. And he was really pretty much a minor pharaoh. About the only fame that he ever really was able to do is I think he was able to restore some of the old polytheistic worship or something like that. But the main thing of significance with him is that out of all the pharaohs, and they had just incredible burial ceremonies to preserve their bodies, out of all the pharaohs, he was the only pharaoh, and his tomb was the only Egyptian tomb that has been discovered intact. Out of all the other pharaohs, the sarcophagus and the pharaoh was gone. Like in all the pyramids and everything, pyramids have been empty for literally centuries and centuries. And so his tomb was discovered intact. And of course, there was a tour, I think, across America and around portions of the world with King Tut. I didn't have a chance to go see it, but there were a number of things discovered in his tomb. In fact, I need to read you a little article, but I'm not sure if I have time. Maybe I'll try to read it here. Something I clipped out of the newspaper some time ago. It says, and I quote about King Tut, and this is when it came to Seattle. The discovery of Tut's tomb in 1922 by archaeologist Howard Carter was a one-in-a-million chance. It was actually discovered accidentally. Found beneath the barren and bleak Valley of the Kings in Egypt, the boy's king's tomb remains, after years of excavation, the sole tomb in the valley that has survived the looting of robbers. Archaeologists could tell that Tut's tomb had twice been broken into, but the robbers failed to enter all the chambers, leaving 5,000 objects behind. And then this one author says, it's difficult to know what they were after when you see what they left behind. See, they left behind things like a 300-pound solid gold burial mask and things like that. So if they were robbing and plundering the tomb, the question is, what were they really after when they left all these other treasures behind? Probably things like perfume, which was considered more valuable than gold during that time. But it goes on and it says, the methods of preservation used by the Egyptians were so successful that even flowers, which had been used during King Tut's funeral party, survived the 3,000 years of entombment. So even the flowers were still intact. In fact, they even found wheat. And they took some of the wheat that had been buried and they planted it and it grew. So wheat that had been planted for all those years, that's how well they buried these pharaohs. But it talks about the gold-colored and jeweled trinkets show little, if any, deterioration. Egyptologists know from studying the wall paintings that many of the objects found in the tomb were common during that area of Egyptian history. Well, we'll go on and talk about this. Really fascinating, their burial ideas and some of the different thoughts they had as far as the afterlife.
out of Seattle to another class, and I get behind. Hey, how are you?
I'm tasted most of the time, right?
Yeah.
But I don't, when you were talking on the tape, about those assignments we're going to do on the 15th, I don't have the list.
Oh, of the things? Didn't it come out on the tape?
Not completely. Or I wasn't listening right.
You know, do you know anyone, Nancy? Nancy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anyone in this class, personally, that you could talk to?